Empire.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. When the first crews entered the burning, crumpled wreckage of Lower Manhattan on September 11th, Joel Meyerowitz saw rescue workers, emergency crews, investigators, but he noticed there was no one there who was there just to record it all. The news media had been largely blocked out as crews dealt with the crisis, but Joel thought that there should be some thorough record of what had happened, the horror, the intensity, the magnitude, so he stepped in. And for the past 3 months, that's what he's done. He's photographed the crews, the ruins, the people, all for an archive one day that he plans to donate to the Museum of the City of New York. Coming up, we're talking with Joel Meyerowitz about his huge and sudden undertaking to archive photographically the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in New York City. But first, I had a chance to talk to Bob McDonald earlier. He's the director of the Museum of the City of New York. I asked him how he and Joel came together to work on the World Trade Center archive project.
Well, a few days after the attack, Joel called me. He, like most people in the country, and particularly here in the city, were reeling from this defining moment in our individual and collective lives. We were seeking, as artists, I'm an historian, of how to respond to really this horrific event that has, in fact, changed our lives. So Joel reached out to us because he needed access to Ground Zero. The city, the federal government were very restrictive in allowing any photography because it was a crime scene. And as a matter of fact, it's also a burial ground.
Mm-hmm.
Joel and I verbally over the phone agreed that the museum would engage Joel to create an archives of the site of the World Trade Center and the neighborhood over the next year until the anniversary date in 2002.
And what do you plan to do with those thousands of photographs?
We think it's going to number in the neighborhood of 5,000 images.
Mm-hmm.
They will also be digitized in addition to the original prints.
Mm-hmm.
They will be used by future generations in many different ways for research, for exhibition, for study. But we will also draw from that archives to create an exhibition and a book. We are speaking right now with several
mm-hmm.
publishers about a book that would not only include Joel's images, but also his words. Joel has, outside of the iron workers and the firemen and the people from the Office of Emergency Management, Joel Meyerowitz has probably been the consistent artistic vision.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want Joel, I've urged him from day one to keep a journal, which he's been doing. We will do a book and an exhibition sometime before 2004.
Bob McDonald, what other projects are in the works to remember September 11th?
Well, we've been very active. Obviously, this is overwhelming to us here in New York, the enormity of the tragedy, but also of the material culture, the artifacts, the architectural elements. A few weeks ago, we took custody of one of the icons of the tragedy that really puts a human face, literally, on the raw statistics, and that is the Wall of Prayers. There were several major ones around the city.
These are the collections of notes and photographs people left.
Absolutely. The families left of the missing loved ones, and the one that we were able to save intact was the one at Bellevue Hospital.
Mm. Yeah.
And I must tell you that it is a work of art. It is an icon because on those faces or on that wall, it was a construction wall. That's why we were able to save it
mm-hmm.
intact. On that wall, you see not only America, but particularly New York, the young, the old, the Hispanic, the Chinese,
mm.
the African-American, the Irish, the young father with his child.
A snapshot in tragedy there.
Absolutely.
Are you preserving artifacts like this one from the site for historic purposes or for artistic display?
Both. We are a history museum, but we tell history through visual culture. So these collections are enormous. This was the first city history museum in the United States, modeled after the Musée Carnavalet, the city museum of Paris. It's for documentation, but it's also, in Joel's case, artistically documentation.
Thinking how recent the losses that you're chronicling are you concerned about putting some of these private artifacts, you know, on display to the public?
Oh, yes, we are. We are not going to exhibit the wall until we document it, and we are contacting every family represented on that wall to seek their permission to acquire that image for the museum's collections.
What are you hearing from museum goers, from New Yorkers? What do they want to see, to remember?
Well, it's a funny thing. There are mixed feelings about this. Some people want to relive the tragedy. Others want to get away from it. I'll give you an example. Our major show right now is Al Hirschfeld, the Lion King, the great artist who captured for more than 75 years. He's known for his Broadway caricatures, but he captured New York. We've had great audiences because it speaks about New York that was. New York has changed, and as our country has. So many people do not want to relive the tragedy right now. We are not, as a museum, into memorials. We are into interpretation. So we are gathering this information so that at the appropriate time, using the visual material culture, the artifacts, we can interpret, at least in some way, to future generations what happened to us.
Stretch your mind ahead 10 or 20 years. I guess that's your job as the director of a museum. What do you think people will want to see and learn and know from your archive and your museum display then?
I think the enormity of the tragedy, and this is in Joel's photography, has captured that. Using a large view camera, the detail, you almost can step into ground zero. But more than that, I think people will want to know the human element of really how New Yorkers responded individually and collectively, and still are responding. That's why it's hard to interpret it. We're still living it. It is not unusual for, even today, New Yorkers to be talking about the tragedy, and they well up. This city is a very injured city. This country is, but particularly New Yorkers and those that witnessed firsthand the attack or were part of it. So what will people want to know? I think they will want to know what a tremendous destruction took place in Lower Manhattan.
Bob McDonald is the director of the Museum of the City of New York. We're talking this hour about archiving the disaster at the World Trade Center site. What do you want to remember? What images do you think need to be preserved? What do you want future generations to know, to visualize about September 11th, 2001? To talk about his own personal efforts to catalog the disaster, we have Joel Meyerowitz. He's an internationally known photographer and has published 11 books of color photography, including Cape Light. Welcome, Joel Meyerowitz.
Good evening, Tom. How are you?
We're well. Thanks very much for being with us, Joel. So you've been down in Lower Manhattan for months now, photographing. We hear workers at the disaster site say that they don't see the site on TV that they know in reality. What's missing in the images that we've shared collectively as a nation that you're trying to capture on the scene?
Well, you don't see anybody down at ground level in ground zero. You generally see an aerial camera from the top of a building, and it looks like a giant parking lot, in a sense. Once you're down there, you see it on human scale. You could stand next to a pile that's 5 or 6 stories tall of massed, rusting rubble and wiring and furniture, and suddenly the enormity of it, the human drama of it, is visible. And that's what I've begun to see is an important asset, in a sense, towards the visceral response to the tragedy.
Joel Meyerowitz, you've always described yourself and been a street photographer, and it's easy in your own background to see the scenes of joy and delight and sometimes tragedy, but this is obviously on a scale unlike anything you photographed, anything you could have photographed. What drew you to this? How did you end up on the site taking pictures?
It's true. I've never thought of myself as a war photographer or as someone who's engaged in making pictures of poverty or the tragedies that occur to others.
I look at your portfolio, and there are laughing children and a happy newlyweds and beautiful sunsets on Cape Cod, and now you're at the disaster site.
Well, I'm basically an optimist, but I'm also a realist, and the reality of that moment that we saw on TV was, in some strange way, made, I don't know, exaggerated. I mean, I heard so many people say it was like a film. Well, it wasn't like a film. It was like reality, but we only can compare it to these film special effects disasters that we've seen. But that wasn't the reason that it was for me. I'm just saying that's part of the surround. Mm-hmm. For me, as a citizen of this city, to not be able to have a record of it felt like a crime against history. And I think the city had the best intentions in preserving this as a crime scene. There were hundreds of millions of dollars of gold down there. There were the black boxes from the airplanes. There were the bodies that they didn't want the aggressive behavior of the press to in some way, make ghoulish headlines
But Joel, tell us, what did it mean exactly that it was a crime scene? Were photographers really, was it off limits to photographers?
Absolutely. I mean,
how much of it? Not all of us understand these restrictions.
There was, within a week of the event, there was a chain link fence put up, I would say, from Chambers Street down to below Liberty Street.
There, how far is that?
That's about, Liberty Street is the very bottom of the South Tower.
Right.
Beyond Liberty Street, three or four blocks beyond Liberty Street. So I would say, let's say four blocks on either side of the center. And that was guarded by National Guardsmen, state troopers, New York policemen, everybody, the federal, the national, the military, everybody had a presence there.
And what did news photographers have access to?
Nothing. They were kept in a pool, isolated outside the compound, and if there was some kind of photo op, a pool photographer would go in, one person, and they would trail after a dignitary or the mayor or something, and they were allowed to make some pictures of that kind of action, but unless they were able to sneak a picture here and there. But basically, they weren't allowed to wander around. You have to understand that physically, it was the most complex, dangerous place I've ever experienced in my life. It was as if it was filled with shards and landmines. And I mean, there was no way you could walk without injuring yourself if you didn't look down for every step you made.
Wow. So how did you get in and how did you maneuver through all that?
I asked everyone I knew who they knew in government that might be able to give me a pass. Mm-hmm. And it was dead ends all the way. And then I came across an old friend whose son is now a commissioner. I can't reveal more because he doesn't want to be known. And he said, oh, yeah, I have an extra red pass, and you deserve this. So he gave that to me, and that was my first toehold, you might say. Nonetheless, with Robert McDonald's letter and this pass, I was thrown out every single day.
For how
Most
long?
People didn't. Well, I would get thrown. How long was I thrown out? Over the first 3 weeks. But it didn't mean I left. It means I just went back out around. I found a soft spot.
Was it because it felt obscene to people to be photographing this or something else?
No. Because the law was laid down by the by the city that it was a crime scene, no photography. So even if I had this letter that showed that I was doing something of use, some cop on the beat had to interpret that by saying, "Well, it says no photography. How could you be taking pictures?" But
Joel Marowitz, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll come back, and we want to hear in detail about your time camped out at the disaster site and what's come out of that. We're talking with photographer Joel Marowitz. He's building an archive of photographs of the aftermath of the attacks on the World Trade Centers in New York. What do you want to remember? What images do you feel a need not to lose? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a gallery of Joel Marowitz's photographs from the site of the World Trade Center disaster on our website. Go to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You are listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Joel Meyerowitz. He's a wonderful photographer who's basically camped out at the disaster site where the World Trade Centers come down on September 11th for months since they came down, making a photographic archive of the disaster, its aftermath, and the entire environment around the World Trade Center site. Here's the question. What images do you feel a need not to lose from this disaster? What will your grandchildren see in the images we save? What do they need to see? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Joel Meyerowitz, you were beginning to tell us how you were drawn into the disaster site and began to take your photographs. How did you define to yourself your mission as you began to go about this, capturing this overwhelming scene?
Having written a book on the history of street photography, I spent many, many years in all kinds of archives, and I had a sense of what an archive should be. But there's a prime example. There's something called the FSA, the Foreign Security Administration, which is housed in the Library of Congress. It's 250,000 images of the Depression. There was a man named Roy Stryker who in the 30s conceived of this project, sent out a dozen or more great photographers, young men and women at that time, to go around the country photographing what the Depression looked like and what it meant to Americans. He wrote a shooting script, and that shooting script was the model for me. Although this isn't about the Depression, it had in it assets that I could draw upon to define this thing.
So what were what were the ingredients you wanted to bring to this archive?
Well, okay, the buildings fell, and certainly the destruction of those towers and the surrounding area were very important to record as they were and as they're taken apart. But what else happened? Every tree in a 16-square-block area was either mangled or festooned with Venetian blinds and chairs and papers and books. Every lamppost and light pole and fire hydrant and manhole cover, you wouldn't believe what happened to these basic street furnishings. Then there were the interiors of stores and restaurants and offices, things that showed the image of flight, people's last-minute departure, and then the dust that covered everything. This was, in a sense, like Pompeii. And I thought, if I could go around here, especially with a group of other photographers, I thought I would have maybe five or six photographers, a filmmaker, an oral historian. We could pool our resources and make this dynamic and deep archive that would serve future curious lookers or historians, people who wanted to actually get a sense of firsthand, through imagery anyway, a view of what this disaster looked like.
Joel,
We've
talked with some folks who know you and know your work and have spent time at the site about approaching these objects that make up the texture of the visual environment you're capturing. We've got a little clip here from Gus Powell, the photographer, I'm sure you know him, who talks, as you have just done, about the significance of everyday objects transformed into symbols of what had gone on. Here's Gus Powell.
My name's Gus Powell, and I'm a photographer, and I've been working with Joel Meyerowitz for about 3 years. Day in and day out, he's there sort of recording what happens and as it evolves. I mean, we were there, I guess it was the second time we went down, and we found this bicycle that was locked up to a pole about 3 blocks away from the World Trade Center. And looking at it, you realize that it had been there since the very first day, because the, you know, Con Edison or whatever, the power company, had built a ramp around it. It's like this marker, and there's certain parts of it there that really are like Pompeii, that there's just these little frozen things. And some of them have survived, like this bicycle that we saw, but most of them quickly have been pulled away and sort of go unseen. And meanwhile, nobody's sort of documenting what's happening along the way except for Joel. What's being done is for the future. It's not looking for, you know, a quick news image, but actually trying to make something that has to do with the visual history of what's happened there. It's understood that he's one of the other hard hat workers there, despite the fact that he's working with a camera and he's not necessarily pulling things out of there, but he's documenting things as they're pulled out of there. And the work that he's doing is going to show the future what they did.
Gus Powell talking about Joel Marwitz's work. Joel, we've seen some of these images of objects covered in dust, and they're so gut-wrenching. They take us back to that day and that awful, empty, just impossible feeling of destruction. But you're shooting these things with an eye toward 10, 20, 40 years from now. How does that change the way you photograph, or does it?
Oh, it does, Tom. It's so amazing. I mean, normally if I'm photographing, I'm photographing for the moment, something that seems appropriate to me or is in my vocabulary. But trying to function as a historian makes it very different. Think for a moment of photographs you've seen of Boston from 1900.
Different world.
Just across street somewhere. Mm-hmm. And what you see are horse-drawn trolleys, women with a certain kind of bustle or hat, lampposts that have curlicues on them, mm-hmm. subway kiosks that have fancy deco design, awnings, signage. All of this is the stuff that's the background. So we get that as a gift just by looking at a picture from 1900. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. how can I stand in 2001 and suddenly open my eye to 2050, looking backwards at 2001 and say, look, I mean, there was a disaster here, but look at what life looked like. Look how they treated fire hydrants in those days. Look the way trucks look. Or how about the equipment, the earth-moving equipment? This stuff is going to look so antiquated.
So the disaster will be juxtaposed with the antiquity of the details that you're capturing.
That's right. And so it makes me more attentive to those details that slide below the threshold of our vision. Mm. So I start looking around at things that I have a sense might change or might be a marker in mm-hmm. time.
Joel,
it's very interesting. Mm.
This was not an empty environment you came into. It was just alive with a desperate rescue effort. And when you first showed up, still an effort to find survivors, I guess. Talk to us about the culture that you moved into there with your camera in hand. What was the culture of the rescue workers of the scene?
Oh, I mean, to me, it's the greatest and most moving aspect of the life in Ground Zero. These men and women, although it's mostly men who are in there digging because it's dirty, hard work, are so committed to it that when they're removed from the job, as the guys from the arson explosion squad, who were sort of my squad, they were removed after 50 straight days, and these guys were crying. They didn't want to leave. This became their life.
Did you eventually develop a connection with them after they stopped throwing you out?
Well, they weren't the guys that threw me out. In fact, they were the guys that rescued me. They were the most amazing, intelligent group of guys. First of all, they're all detectives. They've earned their seniority in a way. Mm-hmm. But when I bumped into them on my second night on the site, we had this funny little, humorous connection. And we got off on a laugh, basically. So they weren't threatened by me, nor were they wondering why I was there.
And did
so
they relate to your desire to record what was going on?
Well, I explained to them right away what it was I thought mm-hmm. I was doing, and they all got it. Mm-hmm. And immediately they said, hey, come with us. We'll take you upstairs like nobody's been here before. And they took me up 9 floors up in the American Express building so that I could get out on a parapet and look down. And they said to me, listen, you have any trouble, you just call us. Here's our cell phone numbers and our beepers. We'll come and get you all the time.
Joel, we talked to a friend of yours, Wynn Knowlton, a sculptor, about that relationship with the workers that developed. Let's listen.
My name is Wynn Knowlton. I'm a sculptor in New York and friend of Joel's for 10 or 12 years. We've exhibited together and we're colleagues in arms. Well, I think Joel being down there, I think the workers really embraced him. And the day I went with him, which is one day, they embraced me also. And I think they were very in need of some other people bearing witness, because what they were coming home to seeing on TV was not what was being, was not really what was there. I think the TV people had long since gone, and every time there were images of the site, they were sort of the same ones from the same perspective. An information blackout. I think these guys were very hungry for somebody to record something closer to what they were experiencing day in, day out.
And Joel, that was you. I want to grab one more clip here and then dive back into our conversation. But there was one worker in particular, Frank, who had found a cross in the excavation. Yeah. We caught up with him today on a break at the site.
My name is Frank Seleccia. I'm a laborer working from Local 731. And I've been here since the 12th of September. Joel is a fascinating human being. He's taken many a picture of devastation of the World Trade Center for historical purposes. He's helped me with pictures of the cross that I found in Building 6 to help me save the cross. He's taken fascinating pictures. He's been here since the beginning. And I believe that society needs him to record a record of this event. I believe he's doing a fantastic job of doing so.
Joel Marwitz, I'm hearing these voices for the first time with you. I can't believe what a cheerleading squad you've got down there at this point. Holy smokes, I didn't fully expect that. But tell us about this cross that Frank Seleccia found, and I guess you photographed.
You wouldn't believe this guy. I mean, he's a great big bear of a guy. He's probably like 6'3 and 280 pounds and rough and tough looking. I mean, his voice sounds so tiny and soft compared to who he is.
It does.
And one day, when I was there, and I see this huge steel cross up on a sort of a bridge abutment, and this guy comes over and says, "You interested in that?" And you know, I said, "Yeah, I am." Where'd that come from? He said, "I found it." And then he started to talk about his experience, and I tell you, this great big beefy guy started tearing up. His eyes were rimmed with tears, and his tenderness, and he talked about faith. And how his faith was returned, that he was just a hard SOB. He said, "I'm a hard SOB, you know." And then he said, "But I was in this building," and he took me by the hand, this great big paw, and took me inside. And he had painted, it was like a pilgrimage. He had painted arrows and crosses, like a Fred Astaire dance step, across the basement of this building.
For what?
Towards a hole. A huge atrium had appeared because the top of the World Trade Center fell into Building 6 and caused a seven-story collapse in the dead center of the building, and it went down about five or six stories.
A kind of cathedral made there.
Like a crypt. I mean, like an atrium, like a ruin of a cathedral, like all of these things. And what it had done is it had sheared away all the steel beams, and one beam was sheared off in a perfect cross, and it was standing all by itself in this rubble, like on top of the rubble, and this guy rescued it. I mean, it wasn't something he could carry away, you understand? He had to have a crane come down and had a welders come in to cut it away and lift it up, and they came out and they consecrated that part of the site.
This wasn't a manufactured cross. It was just something created by the force of the disaster. And your friend Frank wanted to see a cross there, and it meant something to him.
Well, it was, in fact, the image of the cross. If it had fallen into a Jewish star, that would have been amazing.
You would have had it all. Huh?
Yeah. But it was profound. And he recognized it. He took it as a sign. He got it put up someplace. And It adds to the spirituality of the site, but what it's done to him is it's spiritualized this man and his faith. Whether he ever lost it or not, I don't know personally, but he certainly is living with it now, and I think it touches everybody because chance produced this, not a sculptor. But an accident of nature.
Chance and tragedy.
Chance and tragedy.
Joel Marwitz, I have a feeling people are going to be looking for signs and the images that you're collecting there for a long time. We have a lot of callers who want to join our conversation. Oh. Question is, what do you want to remember from September 11th, 2001 and its aftermath? What images do you feel a need not to lose? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Reggie's on the line. Hi, Reggie.
Hi, how are you?
We're good, thanks.
First of all, I'd like to thank Joel for what he's doing. I think it needs to be done, and it's fantastic that he's doing it.
Hear, hear.
There are two things I want to remember. And I was wondering, Joel, if you've been getting any photos of this, of the people that have been responding. I saw a masseuse down there. I saw people from Texas giving out food. Have those kinds of things been documented? And secondly, I'd like to see, a remembrance of the World Trade Towers, how they were before the attacks.
We got it, Reggie. Thanks for your call. What about that? Reggie wants to know about the people bringing solace to the rescue workers.
Absolutely.
And the pre-11 image.
Well, fortunately, I'm prepared with an answer for both of us. Yes, the life in the zone is a profound element. Sure, people flooded in from all over the country, and they were operating the aid stations, the service stations, the food stations, the equipment and material stations, and they were in makeshift tents out of blue tarps tied to 2x4 stuck in the ground. I mean, it was the immediate aftermath war zone image, and there was a kind of camaraderie there that was so uplifting. And these people worked round the clock. I mean, there was one woman, Edwina, who came from Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And she drove all the way across country, and she was there for, she may still be there, but in her post, she was there for at least 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her almost every day, and she was giving out drinks to the firemen and sandwiches and things like that.
She's now part of your archive.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And early on, because to see this, commitment to being part of it, it's uplifting. People themselves are uplifted. So that's A. B is part of the reason I got involved in this is that I had a long-term affair with the World Trade Center. All through the 80s and early 90s, I had a studio on 19th Street in Chelsea, and I had an unobstructed view of the World Trade Center, or of Lower Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a series of 8x10 view camera pictures of it. And my daughter, who runs a gallery in New York City, had planned to have an exhibition this October.
Mm-hmm.
We did this a year ago, and then the buildings fell. The exhibition had already been printed, and I thought maybe I should not have this exhibition. Maybe it'll appear too unseemly or opportunistic. But one afternoon in the lab, I saw people coming by these pictures and weeping. And I thought, no, it's now a memorial. It's changed its content because of the context.
Mm.
So that show is up now in New York City, in Soho, at the Ariel Marowitz Gallery.
So we can remember the before and the after.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and the Art Institute of Chicago has created a shrine room with six of these monumental pictures. By the way, they're 5 feet across.
Well, Lord.
Like a window.
That's something to picture. Joel Meyerowitz, we've got to take another break. We're talking with Joel Meyerowitz about the photographic archive he's creating of the World Trade Center disaster site in New York. What images do you feel a need not to lose? What will your grandchildren see in these images? What do they need to see 20, 30 years from now or more? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. This is Special Coverage from WBUR. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with photographer Joel Meyerowitz. He spent the fall making a photographic archive of the disaster site in Lower Manhattan, thinking not just of how it looks today, but of how people will look at it years and years from now. The question is, how do you archive a disaster, create memory with honor? How important are these images to history, to art? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Joel Meyerowitz, we've got a little clip here, just one more from Wim Wenders, the filmmaker. He's I think, walked through the site with you and had this to say about what he saw there with you.
My name is Wim Wenders. I'm a film director. I work in America and in Germany. And I've had the honor to accompany Joel on one of his trips to Ground Zero. And I think it's only appropriate that somebody like him witnesses and records the developments at this place that is so crucial to, new century. And I think it's very important that somebody like Joel, with an eye as calm, cool, and collected as his, and yet so passionate, present a record of that sight, his wisdom and his inner strength is able to really make us see that place, or future generations make us understand what that meant.
Filmmaker Wim Wenders on Joel Meyerowitz's photographic work in Lower Manhattan this fall. Joel, let's bring some callers in. There are a lot of people who want to join the conversation.
Sure.
Ari is on the line. Welcome, Ari. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling to ask Mr. Meyerowitz that in the past he's been much of an artistic and abstract photographer, and I know that the Cape Cod sunsets and sunrise photos were really much different from the ones of the World Trade Center. And so has your change from being artistic and abstract to documentary, because it's such a, it seems to be such a big leap, made a difference in how you photograph? And also, do you ever think of yourself as similar to Matthew Brady, who photographed the aftermath of the Civil War?
Ari, thanks for your call. How about it, Joel?
Yeah, well, actually, I do. I mean, I feel that in the sense that every great event since the dawn of photography has been recorded. I think it was a real crime against history not to record this. And so I do feel like I've stepped into the shoes of those who've been in a particular place at a special moment in time. And on the one hand, I don't see a change. I don't see my work as sunsets and abstract. I see my work as about describing whatever it is I see in front of me. If I'm standing, in Cape Cod and the light is luminous, that's where I am. If I'm standing on a street corner in New York, that's what I photograph. But it's true, when you come to something like a disaster of this magnitude, do you apply old behavior to that? Or do you try to find a new form for this particular and precise content? And I'm trying to be present, conscious, hold on to the evidence, but also find in it something of a kind of tangible reality that will bring it alive to those people who look at it afterwards. It's not a cold, calculated accounting of parts. It's about the heart, the open heart of what you see when you stand there. And if you feel moved, the viewer should feel moved.
Joel, I've got to ask you, this does somehow fall in that legacy of Civil War photography, maybe even in some tiny way of Holocaust photography. How do you deal with the horror, with the fact of death at this site? How do you deal with the bodies, the remains?
You don't deal with it. You walk past it every day and are stung by the memory of it and the enormity of it. But you go on living.
But photographically, what's your approach been? This is part of the tragedy, the disaster. How do you capture it? How direct have you been? Are you censoring the vision we're going to have of that, the horror?
No, I couldn't say I'm censoring it. I'm trying to stay as open and vulnerable to my feelings, because if I chilled them to some degree so that I was now just being the recorder, it would be useless. I'm moved by this. I've been changed by this, just like Frank. I've been spiritualized too, as is every single person down there. You can't go into that place without feeling the shiver of memory about the loss of those lives there.
And will we see that cost in human life in your photographs?
I don't know if you'll... I mean, there's no way of seeing it. It's not like seeing 3,000 tombstones. You see the mass of destruction and the writhing mass of it. And if you're at all vulnerable, you'll put... And these pictures are made in a scale that allows you to step in. I'm trying to be invisible and self-effacing so that you can get the image of what was there in your gut. So should you stand in front of one of these pictures and feel the horror of that mass of steel falling, the blender twisting, grinding, shredding of it, you might feel how simply human and vulnerable we all are, and all those dying people were. And so the horror of it comes to you through your agency, through your connectivity to what you're seeing, not through anything that I'm trying to convince you to feel. I don't think I can do that. I can just stay open.
But you've been there, and we haven't. And I guess I'm asking, Are human remains part of your photographic record of this tragedy?
No, absolutely not. It's
we've seen them. We've seen that in Civil War photography. We've seen it in Holocaust photography. Death was at the heart of what happened on the 11th, but is it just not part of the scene because of the explosion?
You know, in the Civil War, a ball, a lead ball, whistled through somebody and killed them, so the whole body was there.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you know, it churned, so there were no real survivors. I mean, mm-hmm. here and there, a few, yes, mm-hmm. but basically what's mm-hmm. left, especially after 2 months, mm-hmm. pardon me for saying this,
mm-hmm.
2 months
sure.
of sometimes 2,000-degree heat mm-hmm. all over the site. The mm-hmm. underground fires were so great mm-hmm. that, I mean, basically the remains have been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally they find a bone or a foot in a mm-hmm. shoe or mm-hmm. a belt buckle or a mm-hmm. ring.
That's it.
But, you know, it's not like you're finding bodies.
Joel, let's get one more call. Wendy's on the line. Welcome, Wendy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. I just wanted to comment before the break. Tom mentioned what is it that I would want my grandchildren mm-hmm. to see. And I would absolutely want them to see the compassion with which our fellow citizens met with this disaster.
Mm.
I would want to see the helping hands and the look and the people driving from Arizona or wherever you said mm-hmm. that woman came from. That's what I would want documented. I think that is, I don't know if it's unique to America, but it's certainly something about these United States that makes me happy to be here and pleased to be a citizen, and I would want my grandchildren to view that.
To take at least that away. Wendy, thanks for your call. Joel, is there any shortage of visual evidence of that compassion?
No, I mean, you see it every day. You see, right now there are 75 firemen in there every day and countless police and Port Authority police. And, you know, every time a grappler goes in and picks up a new mound of wreckage, there's a halt for a moment, and a spotter with spyglass, with binoculars, is looking in there. And then these guys, if they think they might have hit a spot where there were people, they go in with little garden tools, mm-hmm. and they're on their hands and knees in the smoking wreckage, and they're combing the earth,
mm-hmm.
Or they're throwing it through a sifter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're in the position of prayer all the time. And these men have you know, just moved everybody in there. I mean, my heart is open to these guys.
Joel, we just have a minute left. Give us a few more word pictures of images that you've seen and captured.
One night I was down there, and seven of us were standing. I was with Wynn Norton that night.
Mm-hmm.
We were standing on a crest, and dusk was falling, smoke was rising everywhere, and suddenly we hear taps being played, the mm-hmm. plaintive bugle call of mm-hmm. taps in the night. And there, down in the hole, was a tiny person who had been taken in by a policeman so that he could blow this reverie for the fallen people of the World Trade Center. And I tell you, if there had been a movie camera and this was in a film, we would all be in tears.
Mm. Joel Meyerowitz, how much longer are you going to go on photographing?
I think I should go all the way to the end to see what happens to the site when it's finally leveled and all carted away and there's some peace there. I'd like to see the springtime and maybe the flourishing of summer and see what that brings.
We're with you in that. Joel Meyerowitz, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
You're welcome, Tom. It's great to be here.
Photographer Joel Meyerowitz is creating a photographic archive of the disaster site in Lower Manhattan. We have a gallery of Joel Meyerowitz's photographs from the site of the World Trade Center disaster on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. More than 5,000 machinists at Pratt & Whitney, a jet engine manufacturer in Connecticut, walked off the job yesterday. The company makes half of the jet engines in the Western world, including some for the U.S. Air Force. The workers say that it's not about the money. It's about keeping jobs in state rather than sending the work overseas. They talk about what it means to go on strike during hard economic times and when the country is at war.
My name is Charles Mitchell. I've been at Pratt like for 30 years, and I'm engine mechanic. I work in the military division, okay? And we just got a contract like $4 million for that JSF-119. And supposed to have a lot of work. You know, all we want is a good contract, and they're like shoving it to us, you know? They force us to do this. Especially around Christmas time, we don't want to be out here. I can't understand how the, you know, the big wheel, why they let this happen, you know? And we over there fighting a war? Like, we should be in the shop there, you know? But really, our back's up against the wall. We don't have a choice, and I think all these guys feel the same way.
I'm Steve Merrick. I'm a business representative with the Machinist Union. Excuse me. And I'm here doing my part. Nobody ever wants to go on strike, whether it's good economic times or bad economic time. You don't want to go on strike. Sometimes you got to do what you got to do. This could be the last stand to keep jobs here in Connecticut, here in East Hartford, where they belong, where they made their money. It needs to stay here. The company is the one to push this, all right? They're trying to wrap themselves around the flag, and if they try to say it's unpatriotic, well, the 500 jobs that they want to ship out of here, they want to ship to China, they want to ship to Poland, they want to ship to other Eastern Bloc countries, ship over to Russia. Well, not too long ago, we were at war with all of those people, okay? We went through the Cold War. We collectively are the people that won the Cold War for this country. The people in the aerospace industry, the people in the defense industry, and 8% of the workforce here in Connecticut used to be in the defense industry. Now they want to move this stuff over to who the people that we were enemies with. Well, I feel bad that maybe they don't have any work, but at our expense, sorry, that ain't the way it goes. No.
I drive a trailer truck for the company, and I think it's very unfair that, I mean, I see people coming in here. These people, most of them don't know who's doing their job in the factory. When I see a truck come in here, I know who's doing my job, and it's very upsetting. Oh, I have a son in the Marine Corps that's over there, and I don't really know. It's real mixed. It really bothers me that he's over there. You know, he's doing what he's got to do, too. But I don't think this is going to have effect on the war right now. They've built up a kitty. Which, being a driver, I know they've built up a pretty good kitty. They're not hurting right now. Maybe if we were on strike for another maybe month or so, it'll start to put a hurt on them. I'm just interested to see what kind of people that I knew as drivers, not Pratt Whitney drivers, but you know, other company drivers, to see what they're like. The Teamsters never crossed our line, which is good. Just really disappointed with the company, that's all, you know. And I've been here for 37 years, you know. It's a long time. It's a lifetime for some people, you know. And to see it go steadily downhill, jobs going, and for them to take this stuff out of, you know, out of the state, bring it somewhere else, it's just not going to work. They sent gears overseas to Israel, and stuff came back here. They couldn't make it. It takes a lot of training, and there's nothing like the New England craftsman, is there?
Striking workers at a Pratt & Whitney plant in East Hartford, Connecticut. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is